When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe. You've arrived at the second part of a two-week exploration of the East End, or Whitechapel in particular. And it's the nature of these things that the walk doesn't sound nearly as exciting if you just describe the buildings that you stopped outside. It is your host who brings the special pair of eyes with them. In this case, my host was, and again, is Rachel Kolsky. If you're a stickler for sequence, I'd strongly advise you go back and listen to part one first. And if you've just done that, I hope you enjoyed it. Welcome back. Rachel and her colleague Louis Burke have written and photographed a wonderful book about Whitechapel, Whitechapel in 50 Buildings. And the Whitechapel building we're starting with in this second instalment is, well, I guess it must be the biggest one for quite some way around. Yes, Rachel Kolsky is about to put me in hospital.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before, just a stone throw from your front door. Hey baby, step out me, see the beats of the air, land and sea, some creep, some saw.
The London Hospital was their landlord.
So helping to fund itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. And some of the little streets on the other side. So we're now walking back. So we're now walking back towards the city. You know what I mean? Back towards, you know, sort of westwards. Some of the little streets still survive, with a few of the houses as well. But when we go inside, there's a couple of things I want to show you, which is sort of between the front of the building and the new back building. A few things. And then I'll take you through the hospital, and then you can see very clearly what's left of the original buildings. It's quite an amazing sight, and it's one of these sights that one has to see now because it's going to change, obviously, quite radically.
As we approach the hospital, a shout out to the air ambulance team up there doing fantastic work for London.
Yes, because you can see up above, over to your left-hand side, the heliport, which is the new heliport. The original heliport was further to Whitechapel Road. It's very noisy. If a helicopter comes in and out, it's amazingly noisy. And the wind, you know, the movement of air is quite phenomenal. So it serves the area within the M25. And usually the helicopter will bring people back here. Obviously, they've got an emergency theatre at the top. But sometimes they might take the injured person to a specialist hospital if need be. I think I saw in the news just this week, or was it last week, that a hospital somewhere else in England has got their helicopter emergency service. I think it's like the third one or something. Don't quote me on the exact number, but there's a few more now dotted around.
The amazing thing, of course, and the misconception often is that they're all about transporting the patients to hospital and that's their sole function, but actually it's much more about being able to do surgery at the roadside and provide that specialist care for trauma.
That's right, because sometimes people are injured or something, you know, become ill in an area where an ambulance can't get to. So the helicopter will go to places basically that ambulances can't reach. So often in the middle of parks, you know, where there's no roadways, things like that.
Well, I was talking to one of the pilots there, and he was describing some of the circumstances in which the air ambulance might be called upon. And a fairly typical one is in the middle of a gang fight where one of the participants has been seriously injured.
Oh, yeah.
And the chopper not only has to deal with the health of the injured person, but they've also got to, you know, deal with the other people around.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is amazing work. It is amazing work that they do. Actually, what we've done now, we've actually come to the spot where you can see very closely the old and the new.
We're passing the entrance to accident and emergency.
Yeah, but we're walking past it, aren't we lucky? So what you can see over to your right-hand side is the back of what I call the Whitechapel Road frontage. And it's not so long ago. So, for instance, you'd come out of Whitechapel Tube, that we couldn't do this morning. You'd walk straight across the street with all the people in their slings and their casts. And then you'd go up the stairs into the main entrance. It was really quite amazing because in the entrance was the emergency bell, and the emergency bell, which was made at the Whitechapel Bell Foundry, was rung to alert staff that there was an emergency coming in. And then you'd walk through the vestibule and then you'd come out, and can you see there's like a little porch with a little green roof?
Oh yes.
Yeah. And so you'd come out there, and where that porch came out was a small courtyard where there was a garden, there was benches, and that's where patients and visitors could sit.
Those buildings have seen better days.
Yes, the buildings have seen better days, but the frontage is hopefully going to stay, because those old buildings have been purchased by London Borough of Tower Hamlets, and they're going to the story at the moment is they're going to be refurbished into the new Tower Hamlets Town Hall. And I think the frontage to be retained, for me, is very important.
Yeah.
Because it's part, you know, it's one of the buildings that's been here the longest. You know, the hospital came here to Whitechapel in 1753, it'd been founded in 1740. It's so important. And the other thing I find about Whitechapel Hospital, Royal London, I should call it, is people have a great fondness for it, you know, and even if people have lost members of their family here, it does happen, there's a fondness for this hospital in a way that I never really hear anybody talk about hospitals. There are other local hospitals. It sort of grew because it was here before the area really developed, and it's developed with the communities. So as the area became more Jewish, and we're talking about in the early to mid 1800s, before the Jewish East End, as I say, you know, the hospital started providing kosher food facilities, special visitation rights, you know, things linked to the Sabbath, etc., etc. So it's always embraced the community around it. And if you actually just loiter here, as one does on a general day when you've got nothing to do, you loiter in a hospital and looking, the demographic here is absolutely amazing. So today it's predominantly Bengali, but actually often you'll see, if you're here on a weekday, members of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, who may be, you know, because Hackney's not so far away, there's a big Jewish community in Hackney, and although there's Big Homerton Hospital in Hackney, some members of that community will be here at the Royal London. So you see the whole world here, actually, go by. But I think the importance of that frontage, and you know, it's been there since the middle of the 18th century. How can you take it away from Whitechapel Road?
Yes, quite right.
When you used to come into that little courtyard, there was one of my favourite statues in London, and obviously the statue isn't there anymore, but they've repositioned the statue. So what we're going to do, we're going to walk through the hospital, we're going to come out the other side, and then you'll see where they put the statue.
And if we come out with the plaster cast on our legs, we'll know we walked through the wrong department.
Yes.
But I know that estate agents look at this side of the Whitechapel Road as being the last vaguely affordable place to be.
Yes, there's an element of truth in that. I think pockets of Bethnal Green as well are still ripe for redevelopment. But that also is what's so amazing about the East End, is that, you know, you can see something glitzy and modernised and renovated and, you know, uber trendy, but literally turn down another street and you're absolutely right, it's still ripe for redevelopment. I mean, if you go down, we're not now far from the Commercial Road. Commercial Road is like parallel to Whitechapel Road. And if you go down Commercial Road, just walk down Commercial Road, it's. I think you're right, it's very ripe for a little bit of sprucing up. But it does have a bath. It's actually very funny. It does actually have a bath store on the Commercial Road up towards York Gate. But it lists itself as the Bath Store Canary Wharf Branch. And I went in there one day.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to record in a revolving door. This is a bold enterprise.
We mustn't touch the glass.
Okay.
Good.
Oh, I might be going around again. No, I've escaped.
And I thought that was rather amusing because they didn't want to say it was Commercial Road Branch or Whitechapel Branch. And one of the lovely things, we're walking down the corridor here, and you can see this sign, Vital Arts. And basically this corridor, which takes us through to the southern side of the hospital, is an art gallery. It's an art gallery, and they have a changing pieces of artwork, sometimes linked to a theme. Otherwise, just very, very talented artists having the opportunity to have their work shown to literally thousands and thousands of people, which, you know, where else could you have that opportunity? And often the pieces are for sale as well. So.
There's some very good stuff here.
It's lovely, isn't it? Yeah.
It's almost worth suffering a life-threatening disease.
Oh, but yes. Or just better, please don't suffer. Just come and visit the art.
Is that what they mean when they say you need to suffer for
your art?
No. Now we come into a rear foyer.
Yeah, and another big revolving door. Please don't touch the glass.
Being revolved out onto here's this must be the statue you were talking about.
Right, yeah, and then we're just going to cross the road to our left.
Well, a little bit of description will pay dividends here. Off to our right, in the far distance, we can see the NatWest building and the Gherkin looming over the streetscape. Nearer too, there's a red brick church in a Gothic style. Some brown brick buildings over the far side of what looks to be a cleared NHS-owned building site.
Absolutely.
Above us, many stories high, is the blue glass of the hospital itself, and to our left,
it's sort of like a covered area from like a porte cochere, sort of like you can walk from one building to another without getting wet.
And ahead of us, that looks like Queen Alex.
It is indeed one of my favourite sculptures, or statues, I should say, in London. Let's go and have a closer look.
No green man to guide us.
No, just each other.
That's vaguely romantic.
Well, that's what happens when you're in Whitechapel, isn't it? Don't you consider it to be one of the most romantic places in London?
Well, now you're putting me on the spot. I'll do a London show. Divert quickly to Queen Alexandra.
Queen Alexandra, and I love this statue. So for those of you that haven't seen her...
I'm in so much trouble with the East Ham people now. If I say yes to this being one of the most romantic spots in London, the East Ham people are going to be all over me.
Why?
They don't like me not saying good things about East Ham.
Really?
Yeah.
OK, maybe they won't listen to this podcast.
Well, I don't
and they
know.
Won't hear.
Their tentacles are everywhere.
We're whispering, so they won't hear us.
Shall we balance it by saying something good about East Ham?
Yes, what would you like to say?
I don't know, you're the tour guide. Do you know anything about East Ham?
I haven't been there for a little while, actually.
Oh, this isn't looking good.
There's that beautiful little church of St Mary Magdalena. It's absolutely so atmospheric with a little churchyard. They're right by the A13. It's a delightful spot.
Are you being sarcastic?
Never.
Okay. Queen Alexandra.
So there's this, it's quite a tall plinth that curves out at the bottom level so it turns into seating for people so you can sit at her base. And then the statue of Queen Alexandra, I just love it because she's tall, she's imperial, she's wearing a beautiful dress with lots and lots of pearls around her bodice. And then she's got this big, tall choker around her neck, which is really very much what she was famous for. I read that she actually had an accident when she was younger and maybe there was a scar on her neck, so that's why she always had lots of rows of pearls to hide it. And Alexandra became Princess Alexandra when she married the Prince of Wales, who was later going to become Edward VII. And I think to date she's our longest standing ever Princess of Wales. If Princess Diana had lived, she might have gained that sort of that accolade. And in many respects, people often have see a parallel between Alexandra and Diana in the sense that married the Prince of Wales, had her children very quickly, became a model mother, a fashion icon, you know, a media star. Photographs, postcards made of Alexandra were sold in their thousands, you know, to women, particularly with her children, that sort of thing. And then, of course, the marriage wasn't a particularly happy one, although in this instance the marriage did last. And what Alexandra did, as well as being the perfect fashion plate, the perfect mother, she involved herself with a lot of charitable work. And, you know, it's worth remembering that, you know, she was Princess of Wales from the early 1860s, and right from the word go, she was, you know, coming to the East End, supporting particularly nursing and medical initiatives. She had a ward here named after her, then a wing named after her. And then you can see she was president of the London Hospital in 1904. But also in 1899, she was Danish, and she knew of the work being done in Denmark by a Dr. Finsen. And so she funded or helped fund, encouraged the first FinCEN lamp in Britain to be brought over to here, the London Hospital. So here you were in the impoverished East End, but this new medical initiative came here, and just around the back of the statue,
Important to note, though, that what the FinCEN lamp
does.
Yes,
I'll show you.
We're going around the back of the statue.
And here you have Princess Alexandra. Relief here, Princess Alexandra leaning over an ill person with the Prince of Wales behind her, looking on attentively.
He's taking his hat off.
It's very feathery, and he's holding it very feathery. And then in the background is this sort of, how would you describe it? Like a tube. It's like a drum. At the top is sort of metal, and then it's got sort of a curtain below it with sort of telescopic things coming out. And this is the FinCEN lamp, and it was a light treatment for something called lupus. Lupus is sort of a condition where you can't, your immune system breaks down, but it still happens every so often. You'll read in the papers, you might read about somebody that's suffering from lupus. It still exists today,
and they still put them under a lamp.
Yes, but it's not it doesn't look like this anymore, but it's still a form of light treatment. Dr. FinCEN was awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine a few years later, she was standing. This statue has been recited, and it's just outside an entrance called the Cavell entrance. And of course here at the London Hospital you had lots of women who had an impact in different ways. Edith Cavell, probably famous for being the brave nurse who was executed in 1915 during the First World War, and she trained here at the London Hospital. And if you, where you saw the hoardings on the front on Whitechapel Road, there's some little breaks, little gaps, and if you peek through the gap, you can see the blue plaque to Edith Cavell, which is still there on the frontage, saying that she trained here. And Edith Cavell has a statue. If you know the West End of London, St. Martin's Lane, near the Coliseum and near the National Portrait Gallery, etc., there's a statue to Edith Cavell, and it was Alexandra that unveiled it. So one of the things for me about London is that wherever you go, you can actually make links when you're least expecting them. And for me, that's the glory of London, that you've been here, you've been there, you see this, you see that, and everything would jigsaw together. And just around the corner is an entrance called the Lukes entrance, and that's named after a woman called Eva Lukes, who was matron here for 39 years. She died at her desk apparently, and I met somebody who told me, because she devoted herself to her nurses but I often think maybe power does go to people's head, because I met somebody who said that one of her ancestors had worked here as a nurse, and one of her jobs was to wash the sovereigns for Matron Lukes before she would handle them. So I love this idea that one of the roles, she always got somebody, I'm not handling that dirty sovereign, it must be cleaned for me.
Well, it kind of makes sense, because in most hospitals you visit, they've got those dispensers of stuff that you're supposed to put on your hands.
You're right.
She's probably onto something.
She was probably just ahead of her time. And in fact, Eva Lukes was ahead of her time, continuous professional development for the nurses, that sort of thing. She made sure that the doctors and the surgeons kept the nurses up to date with new medical initiatives. So, So here, just standing here, you've got this wonderful triumvirate of nurses. And Eva Lukes had this building opened for a training school for nurses down the road at Mile End. And Alexandra opened that. So again, they're all linked. They're all linked in one way or another.
Oh, I'd like to put you on the spot, Rachel Korsky.
Oh no, not again.
Yeah, who would you like to see a statue to with somebody more contemporary, who perhaps has the same kind of vibe as some of these people we're talking about? Who deserves a statue
here at the London Hospital? More contemporary. You have put me on the spot.
What I'm getting at is, are there people around today who are doing things that you would like to see recognised, or better recognised?
I mean, there's a lot of research. There's a lot of people doing research here, and I apologise, I don't know their individual names, but yes, absolutely. There are medical people here making people better, but there's a lot of research going on as well. There's a lot of people working here with cancer research, and I know.
Well, that's the thing. Without the statue or the ward named after them, their name can disappear, can't it? We need
names. Yeah. I mean, years ago, the wards were typically named after the benefactors. I mean, that was how you got your. That's how you got your name in a hospital, if you gave some money. But the thing about naming and statues and plaques and things is it typically happens when you're dead. You know what I mean?
So we shouldn't really be wishing this on anybody?
Not at the moment. Not at the moment. You know, although I have to say, although why it's been like that, who knows? Why shouldn't plaques be put up? And actually, increasingly, there are some organisations. So if you go down to Rotherhithe, for instance, Rotherhithe is at Bermondsey, there's a plaque there to the birthplace of Michael Caine, for instance, the actor and film star Michael Caine. Well, he's well and truly alive, and he already has a plaque.
I often get very sad when I read obituaries. Why reserve all of those positive thoughts and fond memories for after somebody's gone? Why not tell them how you feel about them when they're still around?
Absolutely. I do often wonder the same thing, because they say the dead can't defend themselves, you know. So that means you've got you can say rotten things about somebody who's living. The other thing is, of course, you know, you often don't know until somebody's gone how their legacy and name lives on, you know. But to be honest, there are lots of people doing lots of wonderful things at the moment, and they will probably be commemorated in time to come.
We've arrived at a little spot here where you could convince yourself you're somewhere other than Whitechapel, because the architecture doesn't, to me, seem readily to suggest it. We've got the arches of that Gothic church that I mentioned. There's a very smart-looking building called the Good Samaritan, which looks like a plush pub.
To my favourite building. When Louis and I were doing the book, and we were choosing...
Oh, look at this!
Yes. When we were doing putting together our buildings, the list of buildings, you know, it was quite amazing. We each drew up a list of buildings, and amazingly, they matched almost entirely. We only had to debate a couple. And then we sort of just, you know, said to each other, go on, name your favourite building. And both of us chose exactly the same building. And it's this building that I've just brought in to see. It's called Gwynne House. And you come upon it. It was built in, I think, 1934. And you come upon it. It's like an ocean liner from the 1930s that sort of come adrift and has ended up, you know, in dry dock in Whitechapel. And there's just something absolutely lovely. I mentioned just before how fond I am of 1930s architecture. And this is it incarnate. And when I say it's quite...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Is it reminiscent of an ocean liner? There are some sort of nautical motifs linked to it. So if you look at the front doors, they've all got portholes for windows. And it's got this wonderful, very 1930s, typical 1930s. I suppose in many ways you call it a fly tower. If you think of a beautiful Odeon cinema from the 1930s, where you have the name Odeon, you know, vertically written. And you've got Gwynne House here, vertically written down the fly tower. You've got a lovely little... the windows on this stairwell, they go up at an angle, like at a 45-degree angle. It's the detailing that's really lovely. And it was built by the London Hospital Estate for workers, for doctors and whatever. And it's just recently outside there are three Foxtons placards. Just literally a few years ago, it was sold off, and now the flats are in private ownership. And to be honest, you know, the location is just absolutely phenomenal. You can literally roll out of bed and go into Whitechapel station, which means
that
does sound a bit dangerous, but it means you're literally just a few minutes away if you work in the city or the Docklands. It's really, really beautiful. And I did a lecture a month or so ago. It doesn't matter what the lecture was about, but the book had just been released. I just wanted to tell everybody listening to the lecture about the new book, because if you don't tell anybody, who will? So I just put three little pictures up, and then I did my lecture, which is actually all about portraits in the National Portrait Gallery. And a lady came up to me at the end. I said, "Rachel, thank you. That was a lovely lecture. But what was the picture at the beginning? You know, the one of the house, you know." And I'm thinking, towards the beginning of the lecture, and I'm thinking, but it was all about people. It was all about portraits. I said, "Oh, no, I didn't talk about buildings. It was all about portraits and people." She says, no, you showed us a picture of some buildings. And then I realised she was talking about, not about my lecture at all, but about my bit about the book. And she'd noticed the picture of Gwynne House. And she said, "There was a picture of a block of flats and I couldn't remember the name." She said, "I just couldn't remember the name. I spent the whole of the lecture trying to remember the name of the building." I said, "It was Gwynne House." She said, "That's right." She said, "I started my married life there." And it was so wonderful because I'd put it in as a random picture, you know, because it's my favourite building of the book. And that's the glory of what one does if you explore London and talk to people. You never know when a random memory is going to come through, and it sort of made her evening, and subsequently made my evening as well.
Started her married life.
Yes, isn't that lovely?
So she, in that building.
In that building, and she hadn't thought about it for decades. She hadn't been here for decades. It made me feel very happy. It made me happy. So I think also what I love about Gwynne House here is it just takes you by surprise. You know, we're on a road called Fieldgate Street, and as we go down towards the end of Fieldgate Street, for me, this street, if you don't look at the modern hospital buildings, this street still has the look and feel of what we think of as the old Whitechapel from not so long ago.
I disagree with you, really. This is... From where I'm standing, I can see every architectural style that man has ever conceived.
Oh, actually, I suppose, yes, yeah, yeah. So, yes, so you've got the early 21st century London Hospital buildings, the late 19th century church, 1934 Gwynne House. You've got lots of additions still to the London Hospital. And as we walk down...
Well, we've got the 80s scrapers down there. We're missing that glass fellow just next to Gwynne House. There's a whole building made out of glass. Oh, Rachel's off. Rachel's off. Where's she going?
I think it's part of the hospital.
She thinks it's part of the hospital.
My feet have gone.
Where are they going?
I don't know. They've definitely gone. This is part of the hospital too, but I can't remember what bit. I can see the sign. Yeah, let's cross the road carefully.
Centre of the cell is stenciled on one of the windows. I seem to remember this being some sort of researchy, microscopy, yeah, educationy type thing.
Yeah. So, say Barts and the London School of Medicine and Dentistry.
The Blizzard Building. Institute of Cell and Molecular Science.
Let's walk down Fieldgate Street. Now we've seen the big modern buildings. In the distance, you can see the Gherkin and the Cheese Grater.
Ooh.
All our lovely food-related buildings. I've noticed in the City of London that things have to be named after food.
Yeah, they're making a sandwich, aren't they?
They are making a sandwich, a financial sandwich. Because you've got the prawn as well, don't forget.
The prawn?
Yeah, the prawn.
I don't know about the prawn.
Oh, the prawn.
Where's the prawn?
The prawn is... Do you know Lloyd's of London building?
Yeah.
And on one side of Lloyd's of London, you've got the cheese grater. And then... You've got a building called the Willis Building, and it's been nicknamed the Prawn because the way the bits at the top, they're all set back, sort of like one, two, three, sort of overlapping in a way, in the same way that the shells of a crustacea overlap. I don't know if I've described that very well.
I'm going to have to go and have a look at it now.
Yeah, have a look at it. And when you look at it, you might think it looks a bit like a prawn. Most people don't. But that's what it's been nicknamed.
I've never walked past a building and thought, by Jove, that looks like a prawn.
No. You have to look up.
I've got to say, I'm very fond of the Lloyd's Building.
Oh, the Lloyd's Building's fantastic.
It's like a spinal column, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant. The And when I think of when it opened, it was deemed so futuristic, you know, and so many people thoroughly disliked it. And of course now it looks sort of small and homely, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the... who's the robot in Metropolis?
Oh,
who's the robot in Metropolis?
The name of the robot in Metropolis?
Yes, for 10 points.
That's a serious film question. I fail on that one.
But Fritz Lang.
I could have told you it was Fritz Lang.
Well, who's the robot?
But that wasn't the answer to the question. Couldn't you ask me a question to which the answer is Fritz Lang?
Yeah, just a second.
If you look at the Lloyd's building, it's curvy. It's round. There's roundness to it. Whereas, of course, the buildings around it now are a little bit more angular. Mm. You know, so that's why it looks cosier. So we're just going to be walking down Filgate Street. Over to your right is a building that looks like it's empty now and ripe for redevelopment, also part of the Royal London Hospital. But I just love these external spiral staircases. It's just absolutely, absolutely gorgeous. I love all the old windows as well. I was at my primary school at the weekend. It was built in 1936, and they had a commemorative day for all old students to come because it's going to be demolished and new buildings going to be built. And it's a most beautiful, perfect 1930s building with, you know, but they just say it's not energy efficient anymore and it has too many little staircases up and down.
Produced a lot of appalling people. Better rip it down.
No, it's a beautiful, it's a gorgeous building. And a lot of us went, and we all got quite tearful at the end, remembering our very happy, days at Priestmead Primary School.
Whereabouts is this?
It's in Kenton, in Harrow, in Middlesex.
Uh-huh.
Very, very happy days. But it's just this notion of the buildings that are so lovely, but they're just not suitable for 21st century life anymore. So here we are on Fieldgate Street, and it's not so long ago, coming up to the western end of Fieldgate Street, that this little street was very down at heel, very, very down at heel. I remember when there was only one Tyabs here, and now if you look across to your right-hand side, you can see Tyabs has taken over three buildings, and if you like, sort of like good old-fashioned Punjabi cuisine, it says there proudly, traditional Punjabi cuisine since 1972. Now, in terms of the East End and recent East End, that is almost prehistoric now, the 1970s. And, you know, it was set up by a gentleman who came over and who just had to basically learn how to cook himself. A lot of people came over, young men came over to Britain, leaving their wives and families behind, and they had to learn to look after themselves. There was a massive self-help network developing, particularly in the 50s and 60s, among the Bengali men. Basically, this chap found he could cook, and the rest of the day is history.
Now, was this the sort of food that he would have been eating at home, or was this an anglicised version?
No, a little bit of both, because if you think about it, here we are on Fieldgate Street. How many thousands of people were working at the London Hospital? You had a ready-built market, so he did things like sandwiches and whatever. But also, as well as providing people with what they wanted, he could then start getting them to experiment with the food that he knew. So it's a two-way thing. And here we have also, at the same time I was discovering this area, we're outside now Tower House. Now, if you look at Tower House, it's a big red brick brooding presence, I suppose you could say. And when I came here, really for the first time to explore, maybe in the early 90s, something like that, all these windows, if you can't picture everybody, it's a big building. It's how many stories? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's 7 stories. And lots of small, narrow windows. And what you've got to try and imagine is that when this was built in the early 20th century, 1902, each one of those windows represented a sort of a cubicle for a man who needed temporary accommodation.
Oh, is that what it was?
It was a Rowton house. There were 6 Rowton houses in London, and they were funded by Montagu Corrie, who was the private secretary of Benjamin Disraeli. Now, Benjamin Disraeli was married, but he didn't have any children, and he nurtured Montagu Corrie's career, you know, in a way you'd nurture your own child's career. And Montagu Corrie, in turn, didn't have any children, and so he wasn't wealthy, but he had a bit of money, and he then designated some money to build properties that would provide temporary accommodation for those in need. So often it was really for people who were itinerant. You know, they're in London on short-term, what we'd call today a short-term contract or whatever. But mostly it was for the down and outs. And at ground level, there'd be a chapel. There'd be a place where you could shower, where you'd get new clothes, where you would have your shoes done, or maybe you'd get a new pair of boots, you know, and you'd... there'd be a barber, you know, to neaten you up. And then you'd pay your money and stay. But it was only ever temporary. You could never stay here long term.
Right, because the area was bedeviled by shoddy attempts to cater for those types of people, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there was also the Salvation Army refuge. There was lots down by Spitalfields. There was the Sisters of Mercy, Providence Row. This was 1902. Providence Row came to Spitalfields in 1866. You know, you had the Salvation Army after that. And of the six Rowton houses in London, there are just two that survive standing. The other four have been demolished. This one was transformed into rented accommodation. So these are flats. These are flats with underground car parking facilities, I understand. The other one that's remaining is in Camden Town, called Arlington House. And that still operates as housing for people who are in need on a temporary basis. So you stay there for a bit, and then after the designated period, maybe then social services will come and assist you. But thankfully, this building has survived because it really is reminiscent of where so many people, when they came to London, this is where they had to stay. Stalin stayed here for a little while. George Orwell stayed here, you know. So it's steeped in history. And when I came in the 90s, all these windows were broken and they were wisps of this and that floating through the air. It was quite malevolent, you know. And the 90s is only just over 20 years ago, so things have changed. And then next door, just opposite, you've got the LARC, the London Action Resource Centre. So I don't know if they still do it, but they used to do banner making workshops. So when you were going on a march, this is where you could come and learn how to make a visual.
And like everywhere in the East End, it's got graffiti stick. By a stick on the front.
If I could own a piece of street art, I would want it to be done by stick. I mean, I'm a great fan of street art. I think some of the artists are so, so talented. But there's something about stick's work. You know, you go away and try. Draw a circle, two blobs, a rectangle and some lines, and... you know, and he makes them happy, sad, old, young. You know, he's amazing. He's amazing. As we come down, we're going to end at two more buildings that are in the book. Tower House is in the book as well. But this gives you the idea of the change. So as we walk down, can you see across the road over to your right the dome of the mosque, the East London Mosque with the crescent moon ahead? And there was a time when, as you walk down here, the big sort of pale, sort of, what would you say, orange brick building that you see opposite you, which is the Mariam Centre, that didn't exist. And you had these wonderful vistas, you know, of skylines, which are just changing by the minute here at this end of Fieldgate Street. And as we walk down, you'll see why.
That's a curious expanse of wall with not a single feature on it. No windows, no nothing.
Yeah. I don't know whether they're going to be building something else next door.
Well, we ought not to tell Stick about this.
Yeah. Actually, it'd be perfect.
Yes.
Stick, are you listening? Are you listening?
Are you in there?
Are you there, Stick?
I feel a phone would be more effective.
You mean you don't think Stick listens to Londonist Out Loud?
Oh, now I've done it.
I bet he does.
Almost certainly glued to it right now. I'll give him a call.
He will be, absolutely.
So what is the Mariam Centre?
So what you've got here is really, I think, one of the most lovely juxtapositions of buildings representing the history of this area. In many respects, it's sort of the spot of the area. And what you've got is the Mariam Centre, which is relatively new, and it's a centre for women here at the East London Mosque. So prayer rooms for women, rooms where they can have meetings, education, outreach projects, and just for the women. And then if we walk down a little bit, still keep looking to your right-hand side, you've got a sign, the entrance to the East London Mosque. And don't forget, you've got a big entrance on the main road as well, Whitechapel Road. The mosque itself, as a concept, dates back to 1910. So there's been a mosque in this area for a long time. And then it was on the Commercial Road. Had three buildings on Commercial Road, and in the 1970s, the properties were bought compulsorily by the local authority, and they were then, the Bengali community, Muslim community, were given land here on Fieldgate Street and Whitechapel Road. And so the mosque opened in 1985, as we know it today. And if you'd come here a few years ago, can you see opposite a little building, and it says Fieldgate Street Great Synagogue? If you'd come here not so long ago, that synagogue was like detached. It was like in splendid isolation. And there was this photograph that so many of us took of the synagogue, this tiny little synagogue, with the mosque, the dome of the mosque behind. It was a lovely juxtaposition. And then, you know, it was really tough for the little synagogue to keep going. And then literally, I think just about 18 months ago or so, it finally just gave out and the property was sold to the mosque. Because what you've now got is the mosque gradually grew and grew. Next door to it, the London Muslim Centre for Education, there's a funeral parlour here. In fact, just across the road, you can see a hearse. In the Muslim community, they have to be buried quite soon after death, the same as in the Jewish community. So you do actually see a lot of things linked to funerals.
Actually, there's several hearses here.
Yes, because it's a funeral... What do you call them?
Directors?
Funeral directors, yes, thank you. Now, the synagogue is now owned by the mosque, the building. The synagogue itself was founded in 1899.
Or 5659.
Yes, absolutely. But the building itself doesn't date from there. It was one of the synagogues, there were many, that were badly damaged during the Second World War. So what you've actually got is a building that dates from the 1950s. So architecturally, quite difficult to ask for it to be preserved, because on the exterior isn't ornate in any way. Inside, the synagogue is lovely. It's very homely, you know, with still the donation boards around the ladies' gallery and things like that. And the mosque presently has said that the building will be retained mainly for multi-faith services and things like that. But the story at the moment is that the memory of the synagogue being there, that frontage with the naming and everything, will be retained, which I think it's nice, because that's part and parcel of the history of the area. The reason it's called Fieldgate Street Great Synagogue, even though it was never that large, is because there was at a time about three synagogues on this street, and it was the largest. So you get the idea of how small the other ones were. And in fact, Tayyab's, the restaurant that I showed you before, one of the synagogues, there used to be a synagogue in the back of one of the buildings that's now Tayyab's, which again gives you an idea of how small some of those places for prayer in the Jewish community were.
And it really says a lot, doesn't it? These particular changes of usage say a lot about the evolution of the area.
Absolutely. And I think that's the glory of this area. Whatever comes its way, it embraces it. And, you know, the buildings, we've walked a very small area, and each and every one of the buildings has got, I think, a fascinating tale to tell, and probably will continue to have fascinating tales to tell. You love it when you can stand on one spot and just see all your different architectures. And if you just stand here, you've got your 1950s rebuild for Fieldgate Street Synagogue. You've got the East London Mosque in all its new incarnations with the Mariam Centre. You've got that magnificent red brick edifice of Tower House. And then you can see all the way down, sort of looming, you know, at the end of this ravine, the blue aqua glass of the Royal London Hospital. It's rather quite stupendous, isn't it?
It is indeed. And it's, sadly, we must come to a close for what has been a 2 weeks tour of this small part of the East End. And, of course, it's based on a book all about architecture. How many stories do you tell in the book, Owen?
We've got 50. Yeah, Whitechapel in 50 buildings. So, yes, with my lovely, lovely collaborator, Louis Burke, who's a teacher, he's an educator. He actually works at Swanley School in Whitechapel. And he grew to love Whitechapel walking to work. And, you know, because often he came to work quite early and he saw buildings in different lights and lovely angles. And he started to put together a portfolio of photographs. And then we met actually at Brady Street Cemetery, curiously enough. We met at a cemetery. And I've been exploring the streets, but from my angle, the social history angle. And so we put together the book.
And of course, Louis, we wish you well. He would be here with us today were he not poorly.
Yes, get well, Louis.
As I'm sure people will want to lay their mitts on a copy of the book, where can they do that?
Lots of East End bookshops. So if you know Brick Lane Bookshop, Newham Bookshop, and things like that. And, yeah, those are the best places. Also the A Word, of course. And also if you want to contact myself or Louis through our websites, we'll gladly send you a signed copy.
And the websites are?
golondontours.com, louisburke.com.
Well, for these 2 weeks. Rachel Kosky, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My heart aches for some far off
days. No one could have left you with your name. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Rachel Kosky. Thanks to Louis Burke and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.